Cambridge 105 Radio.
Hello, everybody. It's Cambridge Science. I'm your host, Richard Reddy, but my friends call me Spanners, so let's be friends. I have one friend. I was going to say in general. But, you know, you're close to being my one friend, Dr. Andrew Holding, when it comes to science.
I am close to being a friend. That's good to know. That's.
I actually didn't say that. I said you're close to being my one friend. Because you're old and a middle-aged man, and I don't want to do stereotypes, but I think middle-aged men, fathers, are very bad at making new friends.
I think there's a certain point in people's lives, and I obviously have the male perspective here like you do, that it's very hard to meet people. It's not even if you are terrible or good at making friends.
Isn't it?
The ability to meet new people. Like, most of the people I meet now are people I work with, and I get along with them quite well. I have to say that. I'm on air. But if you, if you go to a sports club, you have a hobby, like, you know, some people do sports, right? That is a thing I hear.
I used to sports when my body worked.
And I don't go down a football club and make friends at a football club. So I have to, like, have hobbies that people get to go. And, you know, I just don't have time for that these days. And it's hard. And when the kids were at primary school, I used to make friends with the dads at the primary school. And we used to sometimes go out for a curry. Now we're in secondary school. We don't even go near the school, right?
Yeah.
We're not allowed within 10 miles.
Well, that's you. That's just you. No, but you know, you're right. So both my kids go to secondary school now and they just get on the bus and go. Yeah, we never get anywhere close to socialising with parents.
If you turned up to the school gates, they would just pretend they didn't know you, right? So it's not an option. So I guess I could take up a hobby. It would have to be something not too strenuous to avoid injury. Have to be quite cheap.
Yeah.
I've always thought I wish I'd learnt golf. The idea of just walking around with a stick. I never learnt golf.
Yeah, it's good. I like it. I'm going to take it up again when the kids leave. That's definitely part of my plan of my 50s, because the science of my body is crumbling. And I would love to see a graph of how much ageing takes away your ability to do certain hobbies, because I've actually gotten back into running lately. And I can just feel every time I have a break from it and go back, my powers are diminished. And, you know, at 43 is my body not recovering as well? It just doesn't feel, I know you're going to point at some bloke like Jared Derrickson, who's 172 and just did an ultra marathon. Well, I'm not Jared, okay? And I never will be. I can feel my powers waning. My whole body just isn't set up as well anymore.
But some of this is like genetics, right? There's people who go to the gym, they work out, and they get really, really, really buff, right? That's, I'm not talking about the people who are also doing other things, like the people who are doing it genuinely and fairly.
Yeah.
And then they might bring a workout video and go, look, if you do my exercise, you can be as buff as me. It's like, no hope.
Yeah.
If I do what you're doing, I might get rid of this rubber ring around my waist. I'm not going to end up looking like Arnold Schwarzenegger in 2 months, because different people respond to exercise differently. And some people are just very lucky. And I'm going to be happy that my genetics put me in the fairly average, mostly healthy dad bod range, right? There's a lot way down I can go from that position, and I can see that is my journey ahead of me. So I'm going to do what I can to maintain my dad bod.
I'm the same. Mediocre is my mountain. So if I can get to looking a little bit out of shape, that's my peak. But I'm going to use the nichest reference yet, because I think it's a really good point what you said about those people with great genetics who find themselves with this great body, and they also happen to inject peanut extract under their fingernails. And then they say to everybody, I'm injecting peanut extract under my fingernails and I'm gorgeous. So you should do the same. And lots of people will do it if they say to do it. So I'm going to come up with my nichest reference yet, which is a random Star Trek Discovery episode where there's a race of creatures that are like genetically engineered to be the soldiers, but their master race makes them addicted to this substance. So if they don't have it, and their masters control that substance completely. And so this...
Edricel White?
Oh, yeah, that's the one. So is it Jem'Hadar?
Jem'Hadar.
DS9. So this Jem'Hadar commander genetically just happens to be not... I hope the boss doesn't listen to this, actually. Right, so the commander just happens to not have the addiction to it.
Yep.
And he thinks it's because he was isolated on this planet. So he brings all his troops down there and says, well, this is what I did, and makes them all sit there and suffer before realising that he's just a genetic freak. And then he hunts them down to give them a soldier's death. I'm going to find that episode. Man, DS9 was better than people say.
I thought it was one of the highly rated ones. I thought people look back on it being quite fond of DS9.
Well, I don't know. We could rank our Star Treks, but then that is getting very...
That's not a science show at that point.
This is the segment. Spanners and Andrew fail to get to the subject, because we do have proper subjects lined up today. And yes. I'm speaking to a real scientist as well. So I'm going to... That's a surprise coming up, but it is going to be the archaeology of enslaved peoples. It's very interesting. It's an interesting chat. I'll play that at the end.
I've got my own science news as well.
Yeah, I know.
When you said hello, I was going to say, look, I actually had something hammered in the world of Andrew holding science, because we got a research paper accepted by peer review, and it's going to be published soon.
So accepted by peer review means you did an experiment.
Yep.
And other people tried to copy it?
No. So we do an experiment. We did several experiments, right? And we then write a paper up going, these experiments, in this case, told us this gene, ZMIZ1, great name. We call it SMIZ1 in the lab. Got to make it short. It sounds smarter. Previously seen in prostate cancer as having a role, but the people, when they did those studies, didn't find anything that suggested it worked in other steroid diseases. And we show that actually it has a different function, which is why we didn't find it last time, but it does have a role in breast cancer. And we're interested in it because people who have more of this gene in their tumour, their life expectancy is shorter. So it could be a future drug target. We don't know. We didn't get that far. We got as far as showing it's important. But we did that. We write it up. We then send it to a journal who then send it out to other people in my field. So I don't know who they are. If they're listening, thank you for being relatively kind.
Wait a minute. You're putting your thumb on the scale there, because now they know, oh, well, that's Andrew Holding, who's renowned in Cambridge for being on Cambridge Science. And now they're going to be scared to peer review it badly.
No, because they get to do it anonymously.
Oh, no way. Oh,
so,
okay.
So, you know, no, they some of the comments were mean.
Really?
And then we had to, like, literally this time, they just said, this paragraph makes no sense, was one of the things. Like, fair enough. It was quite a complicated bit, and we rewrote it, and it was fine. But it's just like, it was just so direct. It's like, no, that's crap. Just rewrite. So we rewrote that, and we did some more experiments, because they said, oh, we would like to see this thing as a control experiment, just check it wasn't like a artifact of experiment you're doing. And we did all that, send it back, and the people said, yeah, no, you've addressed all the comments, and it can now be published. And now it's sitting in the pipeline between it being accepted and it actually, because this journal we went to still has a physical copy, it will actually be in a paper copy.
How exciting is that? I mean, I'm trying to get excited with you, but it's a little bit, you know, when the kids come back from school and they'll go, you'll never guess, Amanda got selected to be in the final. And you don't. Is that a big deal? Is that just the year group? Is he going to be on telly? How big a deal is it?
I mean, it's my job. So it's like, I'm meant to do this, right? We're meant to find out things about cancer and suggest there's cool things out there we can do to make people live longer. But yeah, no, I reckon if you had a chance to be on a real scientific paper in a real scientific journal, you would jump at it.
Yeah, man. So I'm interested in this, though, your actual thing where you said if people have more of this genetic trait, they have worse outcomes.
Yep.
So can you test, or in the future, would you be able to like test, you know, Linda in the office next door and go, if you get breast cancer, your survival chances will be better or worse?
So in this case, it's actually in the tumour. So we would have to check how turned on that gene is. So how much of that gene is expressed is what we call it in biology. But how much is there functioning in the tumour? And then if we have made intervention and found some way to target that, then we could find a new treatment. At the moment, it's not very useful information, because it would just tell us, well, that's not great you have that. That doesn't help you therapeutically, and we have no way to use that information. But we do. Does that make sense? We're not there at the point where it's a useful test to make. So we just tell people, actually, your odds are slightly worse, but we can do nothing about it. Isn't it a useful test to do in a hospital?
That's actually quite depressing. So you've made the breakthrough that you can deliver bad news more accurately, which I guess,
But the breakthrough is we will follow this up further, and we will try and find to see, can we use this as a therapeutic intervention in a way that's never been done before. But it's the groundwork, and you have to you have to have good foundations to build those future things. And it's all about putting out there. Now it's out there. It might not be me who does that.
That's what I was going to say. It might be someone might go, that actually links to something I thought of. And now we know that's true. Now we can create a ray gun that blasts cancer.
Yes, that is metaphorically almost correct.
I'm really getting a handle on this science stuff, you know, Andrew. I'm really getting there.
Yeah. Well, we'll get you that research paper one day. We'll get you published in a journal. I don't know what we'll get you to study, and we don't know what we'll research it will be, but we'll find something that fits your skill set.
I don't need it because I've got Cambridge Science here on Cambridge 105 Radio. We are back. We replayed, actually, episode one. We re-uploaded that because I was on holiday, and we were ill. I had forgotten how ill we were, so the boss suggested, just, you know, reload the pilot, and you know, people might have missed it the first time. So I did that, and then I caught a bit of it later on, and I went, oh no, we sounded sick. Why did we do that? It was because we'd already delayed launching the show, and then we got to that second week, we were both sick, and we were like, we're just gonna
do it anyway. We're gonna make the best of it.
Yeah, we sounded awful. So we're back, and we are armed with news stories. So, Dr. Holding, scientists are asking, can animals count?
Yes, that's exactly what all scientists are doing.
Every scientist.
This was a particular study by the City University of Hong Kong, and they were looking into the existence of a discrete number sense in rats.
So that's basics, isn't it? Because you kind of go, can a rat count?
Yeah, and there is good reason for doing this, but fundamentally, it's actually quite an interesting question, right? Even if we ignore that they argue there are applications for this research, and we can go into that in a moment. But what animals can count and what animals can't count is a really fascinating question, and we don't know.
Yeah, how would you test it? So the first thing I thought about when you said this was I think from the 70s, there was a horse called Clever Hans. And they would go around the country basically peddling this act that my horse, Hans, can count. So people would like hold up a number and they go, okay, Hans, stamp your hoof the amount of times that the person's holding up the number. And the horse would hoof, count, would bang its hoof counting. And you go, oh, yeah, it's true, the horse can count. But that turned out to be a ruse. And the horse was looking at the trainer for cues. And actually, it turned out the trainer, I think, didn't know.
Yeah, so this is what's so interesting about the study. And I didn't know about this, by the way, until you told me. I was like, I've got to go look up Clever Hans. This is amazing.
Go and look it up.
And then I get greeted by pictures of horses, which was not what I was expecting completely. And yeah, it's one of the earliest examples where the trainer didn't know they were giving the cues to the animal. And this is a real problem in testing, right? If you're testing many things with people, especially if it's a cognitive ability, people pick up on things. So when you're testing for autism I know from a parental point of view of a child, they have to really, really ask the questions in a very particular way, because if they put too much inclination into the question, it actually modifies their test results. So they have a very learnt way of, it's very monotonic, very, very straight questions they have to ask, because these things are a real challenge.
Yeah, so you can't accidentally give cues. And basically, it's the equivalent of a leading question. So the horse knew that it gets rewards for doing things right, and it would be kind of looking at the trainer who's expectantly waiting for the hoof, which then is actually a message to the horse to do the hoof. And then when the trainer looks satisfied, he stops doing the hoof, gets food, presumably, or hay. But in the real world, why do we care if a rat can count or not? Like, what possible application could that have?
So what they were looking for here is if they could work out how rats count. You can then do experiments on rats you can't do on people, partly because you can have more rats. They're easy to look after, right? If you take some people and study them for very long times, they're actually quite annoying to look after. Where rats, you just give them some rat food and keep them warm and happy. And what they were trying to work out is if they can understand what in the rat brain does maths and numbers and things like that, they can start to think what parts of the brain is responsible for maths in humans. And the reason that's interesting is there are specific learning needs where certain people just are really bad at maths. And that, I know a lot of people are going to go, oh, I was terrible at maths at school, because for some reason, that's a thing we think is okay in this country. There are people with a thing called dyscalculia, which is like dyslexia for maths, and that's quite a specific thing. And yeah, that's what they're trying to sort of think about. Why does that happen in certain people?
I think we've talked about this before with like aphantasia, and you know, not being, some people can't visualize stuff and find it really bizarre that other people can just make an image appear in their mind. And I can't remember whether we talked about this 2 weeks ago, but I found out, I think we did, that some people don't have an inner voice.
Yes,
and don't have an inner monologue. And you see, so there's that thing, you have to be a bit more understanding with people, because I'm okay at maths, and I might look at a thing and go, yeah, look, we're just divvying up this bill, or we're just adding up our account. And to some people, they just get a, that's a good way to describe it, like a dyslexia type response to the numbers, where it just doesn't, it doesn't make sense to them, and it's not, they're not getting the same information that you're getting. So you kind of, it would be great to be able to just diagnose these things and have just a badge. You know, if you can't see numbers good or you're dyslexic, just have a little badge and people can just stop being mean or expecting things.
And it's really interesting,
a label,
I think.
A label. We
let's
should
label
say.
People. That, no, let's not do that. Let's, there's, no. The interesting thing, of course, with maths, though, is that if we were talking about dyslexia and reading, right, there is a, people really embarrassed if they can't read. It's something that people don't advertise if they're completely illiterate. And it, I don't know what the percentages are out there. We could probably go look it up. But it's not zero. There are people who get through school and they unfortunately never learn to read. And that's not dyslexia. That's just unfortunate situations have led them there. If you turn around and say to someone, I don't do maths, people are always like, yeah, I hate it too. And we have an acceptance in society that maths is something that is kind of a bit weird to be good at. But if anyone said it was weird to be good at reading, it wouldn't be accepted in the same way. So I think it's a real shame that we don't actually have a better engagement with maths in general, because actually it is really useful. Like splitting up a bill, doing your taxes, as boring as it is, getting around those numbers would be really useful. And I think a real challenge is the way we teach maths at school, right? Because have you ever done a simultaneous equation in your life?
Outside of school, no.
and that's what I think. So I generally think, aside from the people who have these learning difficulties with maths, I think there's a lot to be said for going, like, we're going to put you on the maths for real life. Like, I love the maths at A-level. I really enjoyed integration, differentiation. I enjoyed all that stuff, okay? And I accept I'm slightly weird in that respect. But I would like people not to look at their tax return and just panic because it's numbers.
Obviously, now we're sort of straying into education choices, because I agree. I'm an electronics tech by trade. So I did all sorts of funky maths to get electronics qualifications. And not once did that help me in the middle of a airfield, you know, with the wind howling in the dark, wires flapping around and people yelling at me. I didn't ever have to kind of then go, oh, now I need to work out the cos and the tan. You know, it's always, you know, just grab that wire and shove it into another wire. So the maths that we focus on so much is pretty useless. I don't know why we get hammered with trigonometry and stuff at school.
And I think it really puts people off maths, right? Rather than seeing it as a useful tool for their life. I remember most of my class going, when am I ever going to use this? Like that was the response.
So if we could identify, okay, we think a rat can count, and we think that a mouse with that similar can't count, I don't know, what's that helping us do? It means we can identify that in humans and...
We can start to work out what parts of the brain are important. So if you put people...
All of it. I want all of it.
Definitely keep all your brain. None of it spare. Don't believe that you don't use 90% of the brain. You really do use all of your brain.
But Scarlett Johansson in that one movie.
But originally, I think it was a chess player who claimed that. Anyway, we can put you in an MRI and we can actually see those parts of your brain light up in the MRI and we could check how they're functioning. So some really cool stuff we can do there. And maybe one day people will find ways to work out how to improve this or change this. It depends if we need to, right? It might be actually these people with dyscalculia are actually fine. They don't need math. You know, they find it a bit hard, but they're actually brilliant at something else, in which case you don't want to interfere with this. But it's useful to understand that.
Okay, so if we had to guess, which animals do you think can count and which ones can't? So I think dog can count.
Crows.
Crows definitely can count.
All of those birds, they're so smart.
Cats could if they wanted to, but they've got no interest in it.
You know, there was a research paper that was basically showing that cats can understand human behaviour quite well. They just choose not to.
So I actually, this is interesting. So that's the myth of this ethereal cat that's almost like a deity, personality-wise, but just chooses to lounge around. And I could sort of buy into that with your moggies, with your standard cats. But we ended up rescuing and adopting, and now lives with us, a gigantic ragdoll cat. So it's twice the size of the other moggies, and it's got very different behavioural characteristics. So it's much more human-centric, this cat. And you always think of cats as like cold and unfeeling. This cat, you know, it comes in, it checks in on you, makes sure you're okay. At bedtime, it goes around, this cat meowing at people to go to bed and isn't happy until everybody's upstairs. And then when we went away, although we've got cat sitters coming to feed it, when we come back, it's almost like a dog-like response. Like he's missed us. He can't spend enough time with us for a couple of days. And then he goes back to being a bit colder. So I think that the cats can express all those things and have connections and understand humans well.
It totally depends on the cat. And I think that's kind of cool, right? Cats have different personalities and we can see that. So yeah, they're quite... I think one thing, the more we learn about biology and animals and intelligence, what we're starting to realise is it takes many forms and has many ways of existing. And this idea that we as humans are smart and clever because we talk and have society, it's one very, very narrow view of what intelligence is. As I said, crows solve all sorts of problems, okay? They don't build computers or cars. They have some abilities, and maybe things have abilities we don't have that would be useless if they did.
But I feel like things like crows and ants, there's an intelligence there, or there's an ability to solve problems in the same way that AI, current AI, has ability to solve problems. So I'm comparing crows here to a large language model.
Dogs have a level of emotional intelligence when it comes to humans, which is fairly unique, I think, because they have been bred and trained in captivity for so long to be a domesticated animal that looks at you with puppy dog eyes, right? There is evolution has happened there from the proximity we've been together. But crows and actually birds in general, I think I've mentioned on the show before, there was a study ages ago where they trained pigeons to diagnose breast cancer with pictures of breast tumours. Because they have such good visual ability, far better than you or I, they literally, you just said, look at these. If you get the right one, you get food.
Yeah, yeah.
If you get the wrong one, you don't. But if I told you I was going to show you picture after picture after picture and you had to work it out for yourself, that would be a really hard way to learn. It's not like, you know, a doctor goes through all these courses and understands the theory behind it, right? That pigeon didn't get a theory class. They just said, you don't get food if you don't work this out. But they obviously, visually, that wasn't so challenging. They didn't give up.
Yeah, that's just it's raw processing power, I suppose.
But that means their visual ability is beyond what you and I have.
Yeah, I don't think you mentioned that before, because then we went to, you know, the impracticabilities of having to then house all these pigeons. And
I don't think any patient would agree to pigeons doing their diagnosis.
I'm in for whatever works. You know me, I'm much more experimental. If things are going wrong for me, use me as the experiment. You want to chop that arm off and just, you know, use a robotic arm? No problem. I'll go for it. Have you seen the latest Boston Dynamics robot, by the way?
I haven't. I've seen their general ones, which are like the doggy things, right?
Yeah.
And they have a walkie one.
Yeah.
They're always impressive. I haven't seen what's come out in the last few months.
They've got a new one that is... So the other ones look quite bulky, and you could almost imagine that there's a person in there controlling it. This one, absolutely no doubt. It's like skinny, nimble. It can contort itself. And it's less human-like than the ones they normally demonstrate. But the ones they've normally demonstrate are either plugged in or they've got these huge battery packs. This one, I'm hoping it's not real, because, you know, that Will Smith film, AI, Artificial Intelligence.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of those dynamics of robot where, yeah, that sort of size and mobility, and you're like, uh-oh, this is it. The robots are taking over. And I didn't mind robots before this new AI stuff. But now you get good enough AI, you put it in one of those robots, and we've fully got robot servants that eventually overtake humanity.
But at the moment, AI gets a bit overhyped.
Do you know what? I agree and disagree. So I get exactly what you're saying. So I sat down and I had a few days where I said, right, I'm going to sit down, I'm going to understand AI capabilities, try all the AI apps, throw, you know, free trials or sign up to these things for a month to see what they could do for my content. And initially it was like, oh my God, it can do anything. But you do run into the limits of what it can currently do.
And it's really, really good at producing something really convincing, right? That's what it's absolutely brilliant at. But once you... So I was trying Adobe Firefly because I wanted a clip art for something, and that's their AI engine. And Adobe, great brand, right? It was free. That's why I was playing, but you get so many credits a month. Gave it a play. And I just said, oh, I want for a picture of some people learning biology to put... And it, sometimes they look brilliant. Other times it looked like a horror movie, what it came out with, like distorted face. And I went, you can see that if I try and tweak it, if I put really generic things in and got a really generic picture, which wasn't kind of a clip art I wanted, it did okay. But when I tried to try and push it in a direction I actually wanted to make it relevant, it was like, you've gone outside of my really good fancy stuff. And I feel, you know, we've seen, is it Sora's the one that does like a 2-minute video clip? It, like, I want a video clip of walking through a street in Tokyo. It does brilliantly because it's seen and learned a million clips walking through Tokyo. If you said, I want to walk through Tokyo, I want there to be three people in red coats, someone in a blue coat, a helicopter, a dancing penguin, and spanners there, you would, it would just blur, to, it would just fall apart. And to me, that actually shows why we really need people in the creative industry, right? Because they would take that from me and work out what I actually want, where the AI goes, I'm going to try it. And it, well, it doesn't think, right? It just has learned...
Yeah, it's learned things. Someone did a good one of a race car and it looked, it was kind of convincing until you tried to go, okay, can I follow what's happening? So the steering wheel was moving convincingly, but not in line with where the corner was going. And the wheels as well were turning, but not in line with where the track was going. But all the individual parts looked fine. It just wasn't a coherent scene.
And I get it. I'm cynical like this. I'll get people going into the mentions or social media, go, oh, but the next thing will be better. Yeah. And I agree. It's going to get better. But I think that leap from a cool 2-minute video or sticking someone's face onto a picture to make a humorous political gag or whatever it is people are doing to fully automated sentient robot is such a jump, right? Like at the moment, AI is not even at the point of a puppy. It's a stupid 2-minute video.
Well, you're taking fully sentient.
Need fully sentient. If you gave me an AI puppy, I would be amazed.
I think we're close. I think we're closer to something looking convincingly like a robot butler.
Well, take a simple one. Self-driving cars, right? Built on AI. But still not... I mean, you only have to look at what's going on in the self-driving car market. They have not delivered as quickly as people said they would.
Yeah, really disappointing.
And it's because it's so chaotic. Like, what I love, and this is not the whole of the AI self-driving car field, say this, but somebody did put out a wonderful article going, I've got the solution. What we do is we need to control the roads and we need to... And you read it and went, you've invented trains.
Yeah, we need all the roads to be marked out in a certain way and basically be guideways, like a guided busway for cars.
Yes, because people are terribly unpredictable. But... I have huge excitement about AI too. I like just to rein in where people think it's going to go and think about what is it doing well. And pathology, image detection, facial recognition, things like that are going to be huge. The ability to fake videos short enough to cause people to get slightly panicky on social media, that's going to be a real challenge, right? With information and what's fact and what's fiction. So it's big, but it's not AI movie robots.
Well, let's hope that we can hold back the robot revolution for just a little bit longer with the help of experts here on Cambridge Science. In 10 minutes, we're going to be learning about the archaeology of enslaved peoples. And we've got Linda joining us for that, but I've got 10 minutes left with Dr. Holding. And that is time to find out another interesting thing. Can we prevent brain tumours in mice with epilepsy drugs?
Yeah, so this is really interesting. So these epilepsy drugs are given to people to treat the symptoms of epilepsy. And the way they work is they block these channels in the cell that allow sodium in and out of the cell.
Right.
So if you're aware that basically cells are like a balloon, right?
Nope.
Liquid. They're a bit like a balloon.
Okay, they're like a balloon with liquid. That's now information I know. Okay.
They have little channels in the side of a balloon that let things in and out very selectively, otherwise a balloon will pop. And one of those things is sodium.
So I can get sodium salt just freely going in and out of my cells.
So it's not the salt, it's just the sodium. So salt would be the sodium and the chlorine together.
Oh, okay.
And yeah, and this is really, really important. So other ions do this as well, potassium. And in neurons, when you talk about electric currents and all that stuff going, when what they're actually talking about is the charge being carried by these sodium and potassium ions. Now that means these things that block these channels can impact diseases like epilepsy, because when you have a fit, that is an imbalance in those charges and electrical cells.
Is that what that is?
Oh, it's right. One of the ways it can happen. So yeah, so one of them is things firing when they shouldn't. And these drugs, neurobiology is really complex, right? We're not going to pretend it isn't. But these drugs can impact and modulate that and slow it down a bit. So that they work really well. They stop people having seizures. People are happier. Great. What people have started to notice, and this is like a really big thing, is in cancers, and I'm aware of this in the breast cancer field, but they're talking about it in brain cancer, that these epilepsy drugs, these cancer cells also want sodium. And if you use these epilepsy drugs on these cancer tumors, actually, you reduce the rate of cancer and the cancer growth.
Oh.
Because it changes its ability to peel sodium. So it's not using it for neuron signaling. It needs it to grow.
So, again, do all cancers need that sodium to grow?
So this is, like, quite new stuff. So this study where they've looked at this one particular brain cancer, this is new. So, no, we didn't know that before. And now they found it. And they're going, in this case, it's a particular mutation causes this one particular cancer. So it's a mutation in the NF1 gene. And these people who have this mutation, if they give this drug, it slows up the rate the cancer grows and the number that appear. I've got a person I work with, Will Brackenbury, who works on breast cancer, and they've seen that some types of breast cancer, the same thing, they need this sodium to grow. And if you block it, the cancer spreads much slower. So this is something which has really interested people. And what's really cool from talking about my Smith's 1 discovery and saying it could be quite slow till we get to something, these drugs we can just give to people today. We've been giving them to people for epilepsy, so they're safe drugs. And they're saying what they're going to try from this study is they're going to start putting on people with this mutation before they've got cancer few years of this drug. And then they'll see if it slows down the cancer rate. And if it does, we can just pick them up. So we could action this really quite quickly.
Yeah, because it's ready to go. So you're only doing efficacy trials rather than safety trials.
Yeah, so you just
does it
looking
work?
To see if it works. The theory is sound. And then, of course, once that works, they can try longer because people have been on this drug for years. We know the drug's safe. And the other cool thing is they reckon they need less of it to work on this cancer. So it's even a lower dosage, which is even better, right?
I can see you getting quite excited about this. And generally, you know, you're unlikely to get carried away with headlines because you understand, you know, cancer and how it works. So it feels like more and more of these discoveries are coming about where cancer's not one thing, it's all different things. But it does feel like we hear a lot about, well, we found that this one particular type of cancer responds in this way. And it's weird to think about it as an entity, because it's part of you, as an entity that grows and feeds and is quote unquote trying to do things. So is a lot of the cancer treatment for stopping it having weapons, you know, does it need the same things we need? So can I just like starve myself for a year if I've got cancer to hold it back?
To flip it another way around, right? The challenge with cancer is that unlike a bacterial infection, it is part of you. So the differences between you and a bacteria means when we make a drug for a bacteria, we're like, well, what's different about a bacteria? So a bacteria has a different ribosome to you. You might not know that is. But the point is, every cell in your body has a ribosome. But when we make a drug for a bacterial ribosome, it doesn't hurt yours as much because they're different. Your cancer tumor not only has the same human ribosome as you, it is literally the same gene because it's part of you.
Yes, you.
So that makes it so much harder to make drugs. So you have to find unique features about the cancer to target it. And that then feeds into the fact every cancer is different. Lots of cells, because they mutate quite rapidly, in the cancer are different. This makes it really hard. So if you have a cancer like this one, where you have a mutation that arises in the population that causes a particular cancer, then if you know people have that mutation and you can preempt it and preventively block that cancer, that's a brilliant. That's the ideal place we can have impact at treating people because we can stop the cancer before it ever forms. In you and I, who don't have genetic predisposition to a cancer, if we did get something, the thing which always sort of surprised people is the best thing actually is to get it early and cut it out. The surgery removal is far better than any therapy, radiotherapy, drug we have. But let's be clear, you need the other stuff because the cells are annoying little things and they go off and they turn up elsewhere. So that's why we get people with relapse. You don't always get all the cells.
And brain tumours got to be one of the worst ones for it. Is there a part of the brain that's particularly susceptible to brain tumours?
So different brain tumours appear in different parts of the brain. And you're absolutely right. Glioblastoma is the one that everyone talks about having terrible survival. You cut it out and it comes back months later. One of the challenges is when you're talking about a tumour, if you're talking about a solid tumour, well, by solid I mean not leukemia, which is in your blood, you try and cut out around it to make sure you leave nothing behind. Now, there was a lot of research where people kept cutting more and more and more at one point, and people realized that actually the benefits stop quite quickly. But in the brain, you don't have anything spare. If you start cutting more and more of the brain, that is the person.
I really don't have anything spare.
So even the smartest person, right?
Yeah.
They still need it because that's also what makes you breathe, what makes you see. So that's the challenge. But also there's a whole thing, I think, again, we may have mentioned this before, this brain-blood barrier, which stops drugs getting into the brain. So it's very hard to treat things in the brain. So, yeah, this is a real place where survival for patients is very, very poor. Anything we can do to lower brain cancer rates, anything we can do to get people more time is brilliant. And we're very lucky that some cancers now you can live 30, 40 years after treatment and or longer. We don't know because old age is a problem. These brain cancers are ones where if we could get weeks to months for some patients, that would be massive. It's a bit more time to get your affairs in order, just a bit more time.
Yeah.
And it's a very different research environment, right? So this could be really big and preventative. Absolutely. If we can stop cancer appearing, that would be the ultimate goal. And we have done that with some cancers, right? The cervical cancer vaccine, the HPV vaccine. Yeah. Absolutely. If you look at the data in Scotland, nearly eradicated that cancer in young people. There are other forms of that cancer, so unfortunately, as we said, for different types, but the ones caused by the virus is pretty much gone, and that is absolutely brilliant. Those people will never have to worry about that.
Two questions to end on. One, is this epilepsy drug preventing brain tumours? Is that going to help with a lot of brain tumours or just one specific type?
So this research says it particularly is a optic growth NF1. They've only done it in mice at the moment, but that they're about to do it in people to see if it works.
Oh, NF1 is the type of tumour.
It's the gene.
Oh, right, okay.
But I would not be surprised because people are starting to talk more and more about this. I've said I've got a collaborator who does it in breast. I think we're going to see these drugs being used more and more because the idea of what we call the ionic microenvironment, the idea of these tumours using sodium and potassium and things in the area around the cell is becoming more and more recognized as an important mechanism to sort of research and find out, well, does it work for these cancers? And it won't be all of them.
So if you starve it and prevent it doing the things it's trying to do, the cancer starts to die.
Yeah. And there are ideas, you know, about the idea of people talk about diet affecting cancer.
Mm.
That's an incredibly complex field, like what you
and
do.
And controversial, I'd imagine. Very open to scammers and
yes,
charlatans.
Very much manipulated. Very careful what you have to do, and you know what you actually need to talk to is talk to your oncologist. You also putting more pressure on patients and saying it's this and that and the other doesn't always help people because it's not always that clear. But cancer definitely has a different metabolism. It changes how it uses glucose. We know all these things, but fundamentally, it's not going to be as simple as you go and just change your diet and your cancer goes away. You're going to, unfortunately, need surgery, need chemo, need radiotherapy, and to do the best to practice. And now, as I say, some of these cancers, we have really, really good long-term recovery. Sadly, some of them are terrible still. And, you know, brain cancer is one of those ones we really need to improve.
Well, it looks like there's Andrew Holdings, though, all over in the field of cancer research, making those little steps forward. So congratulations to you on the paper thing that you described and I nearly understood. And we are going to see you next week. But next, we're going to talk some anthropological archaeology. I'm pretty sure that's the term. But I spoke to Linda earlier and she knows all about it. So that's all you need to worry about.
Cambridge 105 Radio.
You are listening to Cambridge 105 Radio, and it's Spanners here on my mission to scour the earth, or people with Cambridge links, for interesting scientists to bring you interesting subjects. And there have been some recently where I've had a clue, even the slightest clue, what to say, what to talk about. But today, the subject is bioarchaeology of enslaved people. I don't know what any of those terms strung together mean, but thankfully, I have got an expert here. I've got Linda and Becky to come and talk to me. Hello, Linda.
Hello. Thanks for having me. And don't worry, there aren't a lot of experts out there on what I do and the context that I do it in. So
I've never even heard of your topic, though. So I was, you know, sometimes if you look at the topic and you say, well, it's genes, and you go, well, I understand genes, I understand DNA. But when I hear the word bioarchaeology, that means nothing to me. So may that be my first question. If that's not too ignorant, what is bioarchaeology?
Bioarchaeology is an interdisciplinary approach to studying human remains. We're trying to understand how biology in past societies affected. In my case, I'm interested in how the lived experience of enslaved people was affected. So we get information about the environment that they lived in, the behaviors, as in the kind of work that they did, what they ate, and different circumstances that would have contributed to their life experience.
So you're focusing on the bioarchaeology of enslaved people, and of course, a massive tragedy and a mark on our human history. However, from a scientific point of view, I suppose you've got a population of humans who were doing something very different to the normal human experience.
Right. So I studied enslaved people in Cape Town. They would have been from the 18th and 19th century. So what happens usually in Cape Town is that the developers who are putting up a building and they're digging up soil and they hit a burial ground. And then they have to call in archaeologists. So they do what is known as rescue archaeology. So this is how these populations were found. What I do is I try and understand their lived experience. So from a scientific point of view, but then also interpret it in a way that extends to that lived experience.
Yes. So I guess they were subject to less care, seen completely as a commodity. And so their bodies would have been used for their usefulness. So I suppose it's like the effect of extreme manual labor.
Absolutely. And you see things like grooves where muscle was overused and very strong. You see things like different pathologies in the body. And what I'm particularly interested in is trying to relate that migration and diet to the lived experience. So I find that individuals have migrated several times, perhaps. And that is something I can find out from teeth. And I try and... what I have figured out what diets were particularly exploited at the Cape by enslaved people. And they, unfortunately, we found in one paper that enslaved people, despite the fact that they were living at the coast, and lots of written records talk about them eating fish and salt, you know, the Dutch East India Company would have dead cattle, or there'd be a big fish and a big catch. So you see that in the written record that they're like, okay, we salted it down and we gave it to the slaves. So enslaved people, but they would have been called So I had this idea, my colleagues and I had this idea that enslaved people would eat lots of fish.
Yeah.
And then it turns out from isotopic data, from reference data.
Well, you can tell what they were eating from
yes.
examining the bodies.
Yes.
Wow. So, how?
Yeah. So it's pretty amazing. And so basically you isolate collagen from bones. And then with that collagen, so basically you measure ratios of different isotopes. So an element has different isotopes which which are of different weight, and they move based on how heavy they are. So the lighter ones move quicker. Yeah.
Okay, so are you telling me that I will be found out at some point in the future if they ever find out what I'm putting into my calorie tracker? They'll find my body and go, no, there was a lot more crisps than he said in his diet.
It's not that precise. It's not that precise.
Phew. Okay, well then between you and me, I'm being very accurate. I'm interested with these developers when they come across a site like that will have been of archaeological interest. It must cost them. You know, how often do you think they just go, oh, no, we didn't find nothing. We didn't find anything.
I'm sure the temptation has definitely been there. I'm sure it has been. Well, it's illegal for them to
right.
do that.
Okay, so there are a lot. Okay.
They're ever found out.
Let's not accuse anyone of crimes. But yeah, right. I mean, so I guess the aims are, now, apart from just the raw science of it, we're learning about the lives of enslaved people. And that's actually, you know, a really interesting insight to go, even with an abundance of high quality protein, that wasn't right. being passed down, because I guess there's no long-term benefit for health and longevity. But you'd think you would want them to be strong and to be fed.
Right.
But was that not the case then?
Well, several things. One is that we only know about the daily lives of enslaved people who were actually owned by the Dutch East India Company, because they were there included. You see their presence in Dutch East India Company documents. So we don't actually know much about individuals who enslaved people who were owned by private citizens. So we're not quite sure, what was happening. Were they overworked and they didn't have time to do this? Were they left to their own devices? And so that's a bit of a black box there.
And can your work then help inform modern populations? Because something I only very recently realized from listening to the Revolutions podcast was that in a lot of enslaved people's communities, we all just think of it as, well, that they were African people, but really it was so multicultural. They were from all around Africa. So you had, you know, a melting pot of cultures and even languages. So slaves right. might not even be able to speak to each other.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So as we were saying earlier, that the Dutch East India Company exploited its seaborne empire, and that covered the entire Indian Ocean basin. So in slave societies, which many of the societies that the Dutch East India Company interacted with, there were people available to buy. The only difference is that what would have the trade before, indigenous trades before, wouldn't necessarily have been as long distance. They didn't, the individuals or the enslaved people wouldn't have traveled such long distances as they would when the Dutch came into power. So that makes it even more difficult to understand each other. If you have an Indonesian person working for a master with a Mozambican person, there is no common culture, no common language. And that's actually why Afrikaans came into being. Afrikaans was often called kitchen speak or kitchen language.
I'm with you. Yeah.
because that's where it developed. It developed where workers were, and they were trying to understand each other, and it has some structure based on indigenous language.
And I guess some on the Dutch language as well, I'd imagine.
It definitely. So Dutch, it has some Indonesian words, some indigenous words. So yeah, people had to understand each other, and this is where this Creole language came into being.
I was really interested about you talking about the effects on bodies and where overworked muscles were leaving actual physical marks on the bones. So this is your dissertation, is that what it is, about the effects of bodies of marginalized people?
Luckily for me, there's a lot of data on osteological data. So my contribution was these migration histories and these dietary histories, but also a lot of archival information. I spent quite a lot of time in I learned Dutch, so that
I'm so sorry.
Dutch East India Company records, which are extensive.
I love you, scientists. Just casually. Oh, and then I learned Dutch. Shut up, clever person. So do you see any of those effects kind of going forward in the population? So what you have is, big communities from around the world being exposed to a similar and extreme working conditions. I mean, is there anything of that that is kind of traceable to modern human populations?
Well, you can, although of late I haven't been such a big fan of generating a lot of data and statistical interpretations. I think it's actually more important to concentrate on individuals and say as much about an individual as you can.
Their human experience at the time.
And their human experience. So for me, what more than the physical effects on individuals, although there's some people who've done ancestry, ADNA ancestry research. And of course, as you can imagine, there's evidence of all these populations meeting up in this melting pot in Cape Town. It turns out, you wouldn't believe it. I'm not quite sure how this ancestry business works, but
you're Dutch.
They gave me a percentage. Yeah. No, I'm Portuguese, apparently.
Oh, right, there you go. Was that a surprise?
Surprise, I didn't know where that came from.
Yes, it's not. Mbeki is not a classic Portuguese name. So.
No, I don't look like I have Portuguese ancestry. I mean, I made up a whole story around it, and I mean, it's all fiction, but it was fine.
Headcanon for your own DNA is absolutely acceptable. Look, before I go, I definitely want to get you back because I've spent all of this time saying, hey, what are these basic words and what do they mean? Broadly speaking, though, with your work, is there sort of an aim, an end point, or is it just a journey of discovery?
I think it's a bit of both. There are different ways to study human remains. I mean, some people develop methodologies, which I use. So that can be their interest. For me, it's more the social aspect of enslaved people's lives.
I mean, you've even created in this my head this scene of the people thrust into, say, that kitchen environment, not being able to communicate and basically developing a whole micro culture that then blossoms and comes together. I mean, that in itself is fascinating. That's a movie right there.
Yeah, it is. It's several movies, and I'm particularly interested in how society in Cape Town actually was, well, colonial society in Cape Town affected other colonial communities or other settler communities further north in South Africa. And I see a lot of overlap, but this is mostly like secondary literature research. But yeah, it's all very interesting. I used to be a Cape specialist. Now I'm moving further north. I'm doing history on Johannesburg. and all the interconnectedness of these societies in South Africa.
Definitely fascinating. I am keen to learn more. Where can people follow you online? Can we stalk your social media?
Well, I'd much rather people just drop me an email.
Oh, tell us where to email you.
Yeah, it's lm2028@cam.ac.uk.
One more time, because people have been scrambling around. They're scrambling for a pen and they're like, I didn't get it. Go on.
lm2028@cam.ac.uk.
And I'm sure Linda will be more than happy to give you further reading or answer your questions.
Absolutely.
And since she doesn't have social media, I'll be giving out her home address later. So you can just go and knock on the door. Thank you so much for your time, Linda. That's all the time we have here on Cambridge Science. Go and subscribe to the podcast and go and tell Cambridge 105 Radio that you don't mind Spanners and Dr. Holding talking in an interested and silly way about science. Until we see you next, work hard, be kind, and have fun. This was Cambridge Science.
Cambridge 105 Radio.